Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to have you with us. This time we have two guests in studio with us because we have big things to talk about. Our first guest is Jim Vogel, editor and chief of Angelus Press and spokesman for the St. Pius X Society here in America. Hello, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And our other guest is Father Hugh Barber, our chaplain, here to make sure that I remain charitable to Jim. Did you know that's your role?
And to your wife.
And to my wife. Yeah, well, you help me with that all the time, Father. Okay, so the St. Pius X Society, there will be many among our listeners, I imagine, who are not even familiar with the Society. So I want to start with a basic question that you probably get a lot. What is wrong with you people? Oh, wait, no, that came out wrong. Maybe you could just tell us about the society, St. Pius X Society.
That's fine. I do think it's important to start with some historical perspective because I don't know that you can understand any of the current events surrounding the society without knowing where they came from. And that means, in a way, starting with their founder, a French archbishop named Marcel Lefebvre, who before the Second Vatican Council, before there was such a thing as the Society of St. Pius X, was an archbishop in primarily French-speaking Africa, where at one point he was the apostolic delegate of Pope Pius the XII. And then he was subsequently elected Superior General of the Holy Ghost Fathers, the Spiritans, and retired in the late 1960s after many decades of service to the Catholic Church, and in a way was forced out of retirement providentially, one might say, by some seminarians who had come to him asking for a formation that would have been something similar to what they would have found before the Second Vatican Council. And having had experience in that field, Archbishop Lefebvre tried to organize formation that would be recognizable to someone who had gone to a Catholic seminary prior to the Second Vatican Council. And so this eventually led to the creation of a religious congregation called the Society of St. Pius X.
So the council ends in 65.
That's right.
About what year are these men asking?
So this was 1968 and 1969.
Okay.
And I think at the time, he tried to find existing programs. I think Freiburg in Switzerland was one of the—
Exactly, yeah.
With the places where he was sending men for formation, and for a lot of reasons it wasn't working out. And this led to the discussion of an institute that would focus on the formation of priests. And I think that's
an international seminary.
That's right. And that's interesting because I think your listeners probably know the society for things which they oppose, such as certain aspects of the liturgical reform or the Second Vatican Council, whereas if you read the statutes of the Society of St. Pius X when they were canonically erected by the church, it's entirely focused on priestly formation. And all of these other controversies, which are real, come as a result of disputes that arise primarily in the 1970s because of what Archbishop Lefebvre was trying to do in his international seminary.
So, all right. Well, you may not know this, but in the period since the Vatican Council, we have actually had some problems in the Catholic Church with the formation of priests. You may not be aware of that. So this comes in the context of not just the society wanting a certain type of formation, but also a general kind of tumult in formation. And so this meant a lot of conflict.
It did. And I think if you go back and read some of the firsthand testimonies of seminarians coming to this retired archbishop in the late 1960s, it would give some valuable historical perspective as to what would have led even to the idea of founding an international seminary at the time dedicated to a more traditional or classical priestly formation.
Well, and in terms of my own community, which is the Norbertine Fathers of St. Michael's Abbey in Orange, our founding abbot, Abbot Ladislaus, who was very concerned about the formation of the priests of the community, and he wanted to send them abroad because he didn't think there was anything in the States that would be sound. And he considered Rome, but before he considered Rome, he went to Cologne or to Freiburg and visited the bishop there and Lefebvre and all that. And our seminarians went and experienced what they had there. This was in the 69, 70, it was still legitimate. Legitimate in the sense, the full sense of the term. And they were very impressed by what they saw, but they were not happy with the attitude of contestation to the Holy See. So they were, as you would understand with American Catholics, they didn't want anything which sounded like they were opposing the Holy Father. So the abbot actually eventually moved them from Austria to Rome to study there. But there was always that deep sympathy from the beginning, and he tried, but he figured it wouldn't, and it would have complicated things for us. But just, I'm just saying that from a personal point of view in our own local history.
Interesting.
It's pretty close, because there were bishops from all around the world trying to establish themselves, and with the help of Archbishop Lefebvre in this international seminary, which then was trashed basically later on.
If you ask any average lay person, what's the Society of St. Pius X? What's the issue there? They would say they are right-wing Catholics who want the traditional Mass.
To the extent that the average man in the pew has heard about the Society of St. Pius X, it is probably in reference to a perceived schismatic or parallel church that broke away from the Catholic Church in 1988 we're jumping over a lot of history here, but Archbishop Lefebvre consecrated four bishops without the explicit permission of Pope John Paul II. And the traditional Mass would obviously be a part of that equation. But I think in 2019, because of the vast – well, there are many religious orders and diocesan priests who now say the traditional Mass. I don't know to what extent people identify the traditional Mass with the Society of St. Pius X. I get the impression, and maybe you would be able to answer this better than I could, the impression is one of a almost esoteric and bizarre splinter group. That, I think, is the average impression that a Catholic might have of the Society of St. Pius X.
But
I don't think they would know much about
esoteric and bizarre as much as maybe angry.
Okay.
I'm just trying to formulate what's out there. But I don't know, Father.
I would say angry or stilted.
Okay. We're not giving you our impression, it's just what's out there.
The public image
of
is
course.
Like that
okay.
These people live with themselves. It's kind of the Amish image.
Sure.
So right? I was
which they're not
which gives you the impression of a self-enclosed community
right.
That
yeah. Is not
right.
Two things that surprised me in our earlier conversations,
sure.
Off-air conversations in preparation. One that you don't have lay members of the Society of St. Pius X.
It's true. People who attend Mass at a Society of St. Pius X chapel are not members. The members are the religious,
clergy,
the priests.
Right.
So it's
like Opus Dei. Opus Dei, the members are the priests who are under the prelature. Everybody else is just receiving their services.
Right. So as a practical example, I am not a member of the Society of St. Pius X, and unless I were to be ordained, which is unlikely given my current circumstances.
Because your wife would disapprove.
I suspect that's the case.
How many kids do you have?
I have four.
Four are good.
Oh, the kids wouldn't like it either.
No.
I suspect not. But
the other thing.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead.
So, if the first is that I didn't know that it wasn't a community that had lay members. The second is if you had asked me, I probably would have said the primary issue is the Mass, the liturgy, and that is not the case. That is not the primary issue. That's kind of at this heart of the contention.
It's true. The doctrinal issues at stake would be, if you want to say, the central issue. But I think the liturgical question is probably the more practical, on the ground reality for people who would attend a chapel of the Society of St. Pius X. But for the organization, as an organization, as a Catholic religious order, it's more. The question of doctrinal continuity or perceived lack thereof in the documents of the Second Vatican Council, and the more theoretical concerns about the liturgical reform. So you're right.
The primary doctrinal concern has to do with what is called variously by various different people, a religious tolerance, religious liberty, religious freedom. Is that the primary?
I think it's fair to say that's probably the, if you had to say, is there one issue which there seems to be a disparity of opinion regarding preconciliar magisterial teaching and the Second Vatican Council? It would surround the question of religious liberty. And especially, again, not to mention something we were discussing off air, maybe if you took a look at Dignitatis Humanae, which is the document of the Second Vatican Council on this question, and something like Pius XI's encyclical Quas Primas, you would get a sense, even from a layman's perspective, of the apparent
difference.
Yeah. And that's we could probably do two whole issues or two whole hours on the question of religious liberty, but it does get into a more complicated doctrinal question.
So the doctrinal question is very firmly that Christ, as the incarnate Word, is the head of the human race, and therefore he's the king of the human race.
Yes.
And therefore, the religion revealed by him and the worship which he established for the human race is normative for human beings. And so the church needs to assert that continuously and not treat what our Lord instituted for our salvation, the sacraments, the Mass, all of that, as though it were some kind of observance that we can then accommodate to various traditions.
Right.
And that's the problem. And it can be dealt with very, very simply in the sense that we recognize and we can tolerate the particular limitations on human freedom or human understanding that exist within the cultures of the world or in their politics. But the church always has to assert firmly that Christ has the right to be worshiped as the head of the human race. And that's kind of that's really the if you just take it to Jesus, you know, it's not a it's not an ideological, it's not a political doctrine. It has to do with the headship of Christ of the human race.
And the way you phrase it, Father, I have to say, is very sympathetic to the society's position. I would think you would find those words.
You know, I would like to say first that I don't like phrasing it in terms of the society's position.
Okay. Because, okay. Fair enough.
Again, maybe
the
I'm
church's position.
Well, that's one way I could put it. But I would say that what seems to be the teaching of the Catholic Church, insofar as it was manifested in magisterial documents before the Second Vatican Council, mm-hmm. Would be the society's position. I don't want to give the impression. I would argue that they don't have a position of their own as such. And so, to Father's point, I think the practical dilemma becomes, if there is a difference of language in magisterial documents, and if there is an apparent change between, let's say, Pius XI and Vatican II, and I'm just giving that as an example, is it a change of policy based on prudential circumstances which have changed, or is it something deeper? Is it a manifestation of a different doctrinal perspective? And this is actually played out in the liturgy, because the feast, at least in the Latin Church, the Feast of the Kingship of Christ, I think was instituted as a result of Quas Primas by Pius XI.
In that encyclical, he establishes it.
And I think in the new calendar that feast has been retained, but it's been moved to the end of the liturgical year.
The last Sunday of the liturgical year.
Which has, I think, a different dimension eschatologically, or there was some, I get the impression anyway, that when the Reformers moved that feast, there was a desire to emphasize the coming kingship of our
right.
Lord Jesus
and not,
Christ
not as the actual social and right. public kingship. Yeah, that's true. What Pius the 11th had in mind was the fact that the Feast of Christ the King would be on the last Sunday of October,
right.
which was in Europe, in Germany and other countries, the Feast of the Reformation.
So this is something similar to today, the Feast of St. Joseph the Worker and
right,
May Day,
exactly.
right?
Right. May Day was established with Joseph the Worker, and Christ the King was the Feast of the Reformation Sunday. And anybody that lives in the Midwest knows that there's a Reformation Sunday on
right.
in the Midwest. And so that was one aspect of the whole question that, inspired Pius XI to do what he did. But I wouldn't say that the new liturgy is entirely wrong in this regard, because the kingship of Christ is eschatological. It is for the end times. It is for the final fulfillment of all things. But it is true that they remove from the liturgy, in the new liturgy at least, any references to Christ's actual and current governance Dominion. Of the human race. And that's a question which is for theologians, but it's a real question.
So what does a society member or a person affiliated with the Society of St. Pius X mean by the word modernism then? This is a very common word. And does it mean just this idea that this separation of church and state, or what does modernism refer to?
Modernism as a theological concept okay. has to do with terms like vital immanentism and things which I guess if I were to try to summarize it in a sentence, the notion that objective religious truth comes from inside one's own personal experience yep. and has less to do with an objective deposit of faith, which is taught by
I got it.
The
You're
Catholic
exactly
Church.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's true that colloquially, most people who use the word modernist, whether they're traditional Catholics or not, probably use it just to mean all the changes that have happened in the 20th century, sometimes even before the Second Vatican Council. But as a theological term, I would defer to Father, but I think it has a much more restricted usage than most people would imply by it.
It means basically that revelation is a result of human, subjective human experience.
Okay.
It's a post-Kantian idea of the way in which God would relate himself to the human race. And so it's pretty sophisticated, actually.
And it seems historically to derive out of these historical controversies
right,
about
exactly.
the person of Jesus Christ and how to make his nature and person known to human beings.
And how he experienced himself as a man, his relation to the Father. So there's some deep theology there, and the modernist crisis, it wasn't entirely, I mean, the modernists were not entirely off base. They needed some guidance from the magisterium, but they were so far off base that they just received a very firm doctrinal correction.
Okay.
Which then made it difficult for many people to accept, but in point of fact, it was a great grace for the church, which kept many confusing ideas from being diffused among the faithful.
I'm going to move to the current status
sure.
of the society, but I want did we reflect enough on the history?
I think so. If we have a chance, we can always go back
okay.
and delve into it deeper. But again, that's something that we could.
So the society is formed as a priestly society to form
right.
men in the pre-Vatican II. Or is that pejorative to say it that way, or just the way that men were phrased before?
They didn't observe the pre-Vatican II liturgy. They observed the Vatican II liturgy as it was established up to that point.
I see. So, but to give a formation that was a more traditional formation.
That's correct.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Okay, so this, at a certain point, this means that a community forms around this society, right. this priestly society. In 1998, Archbishop Lefebvre, who is leading this society, is obviously considering his own mortality. And so
right.
Things happen, things are said, but four bishops are consecrated by Archbishop Lefebvre.
Right.
And so this is an act that results in what canonical consequences? What comes from that?
So in 1988, what happens is that even before 1988, the Archbishop had been, and this is where maybe the history is important, he had already been suspended in 1976 for ordaining priests without the permission
okay.
of Rome. And that's its own complicated history. But for the sake of brevity, by 1988, he was older. The relationships with Rome, even on a human level, were rather difficult. And there had been an agreement in May of 1988, in principle at least, to allow Archbishop Lefebvre to consecrate another bishop and to clarify even then some of the canonical irregularities that had surrounded the Society of St. Pius X. The real point of departure was that they couldn't agree on a date. So Archbishop Lefebvre, in a way, made an ultimatum to Rome, saying if we can't agree on a date for the agreement of episcopal consecrations, I will go ahead anyway, mm-hmm. and arguing, to be fair to him, that he thought he would argue that in principle Rome had given him permission to consecrate a bishop, but they were haggling over details, which I'm not trying to simplify this.
But
it's true that in 1988, four bishops are consecrated without the explicit permission of the Holy Father, which in canon law is, at least theoretically, a very grave offense. And so there is a notification then from Pope John Paul II saying that it was an act of schism and that by consecrating these bishops, Archbishop Lefebvre had essentially excommunicated himself. He had been warned by Rome that if he went ahead, this would be the consequence. So in that sense, it wasn't a surprise. And of course, this inaugurates this period, I would say, that leads roughly from the consecrations in 1988 to around the year 2000, where there was the appearance, on the one hand, of a parallel church, a real schism, but mm-hmm. The society would have argued at the time that they had taken advantage of certain provisions in canon law and theology that would have allowed them to operate in a kind of state of emergency where the normal laws didn't apply. And again, we could go into what those arguments are, but I think it's probably more helpful for this conversation to say that from the period of 2000 to essentially 2019, there has been a series of developments canonically and pastorally that affect the Society of St. Pius X. And to sum it up, to the extent that I can, I would say in 2019, there's still not a clear canonical solution. There's no longer any language of not being Catholic or being in schism. Pope Benedict XVI lifted any excommunications and obviously with Summorum Pontificum made it evident that the traditional mass, the extraordinary form as it's often called, can be offered by any priest if they so desire. And Pope Francis has extended permissions for jurisdiction for marriages and confessions, which were historically a disputed point. So right now in 2019, it's a gray area. And we can use words like it's a canonically irregular situation, which while true doesn't necessarily clarify things as much as we might like.
It's kind of a descriptor and a gentle descriptor. It strikes me that what's in all that you've said, you get a sense of a lot of practical accommodations being made on both sides that are allowing for a practical working relationship without actually resolving doctrinal issues.
I think that's fair. And okay. So on the one hand, from the perspective of the Society of St. Pius X, a lot of these practical provisions that would affect confessions or marriages or even the establishment of new houses or other canonical questions that are important are meant to be signs of a practical willingness to submit to Rome to show that, you know, we're not a parallel church, that we don't think we have the authority to just do whatever we want. On the other hand, these questions that go back long before the episcopal consecrations of 1988, for instance, how can we resolve this apparent discontinuity on the question of religious liberty are still to be clarified. And I think it's fair to say that the Society of St. Pius X would very much like Rome to demonstrate how certain questions we have can be read in continuity with tradition. And in a way, you can say that we're waiting on the authorities, the proper authorities, let's say the CDF, to make those clarifications.
It frankly seems that you've kind of won and lost with the current Pope, because he's all about practical solutions and seems not particularly interested in doctrinal issues in many ways. And I'm not saying that in any way to be pejorative towards the Pope. It's just people have their priorities. They have, and he doesn't.
What's interesting about the present Pope is that before he was the Holy Father, when he was the Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires, he got to know the Society of St. Pius X on the ground, so to speak. We operate a seminary right outside of Buenos Aires. And so there had been reason for contact. I forget initially if – I think we had asked permission maybe to use one of the churches in Buenos Aires for a pilgrimage or some occasion. And so he got to know our priests there. And on a personal level, it seems like they hit it off.
Yeah.
We were perceived to be working on the periphery or not looking for a clerical career. And I think it's safe to say we're not wealthy as an organization. And so, you know, maybe we didn't have the nicest cassocks in Argentina, or we weren't out
there.
That
means a lot to this Pope. That
it seemed to mean a lot to the point where this is maybe getting off into the weeds a bit. After he became the Pope, there was a legal question in Argentina about whether or not we could operate as a Catholic organization, because there's some kind of concordat or legal understanding between the state and the church in Argentina where if you are recognized by the Catholic Church, you have a claim to the title Catholic and you have certain legal or financial benefits which you wouldn't get, let's say, I'm not privy to the details of the nonprofit laws in Argentina, but Pope Francis personally intervened with the state of Argentina to have the Society of St. Pius X, at least in Argentina, recognized as a Catholic organization. So that doesn't really mean anything canonically, but it shows on a personal level the attitude of Pope Francis towards the Society of St. Pius X.
But it seems to mean more practical benefits, more practical goods, but still no advancements of the doctrinal issues.
I think that's fair, and I also think it's fair to say, broadly speaking, that from the early to mid 70s until now, it's the Society of St. Pius X that has requested clarification of these issues. In fact, to your point earlier, there was a formal attempt in the mid 80s. I think it was 1985 where a dubia was sent, a formal document was sent to the congregation, the CDF, on the question of religious liberty. So isolating that particular question and laying out in great theological detail what our concerns were, what our objections were, and asking the CDF to answer these questions. And there was a response, both of which are public. You can find them. We actually sell the dubia if you want to read it. You can find them both online. They're easy to find. But to our perspective, and really I don't think you can it's actually written like the document Dignitatis Humanae, because the opening letter of the response to the dubia says, well, of course it's an incontestable novelty. That's the words of the response to the dubia, is of course the doctrine's an incontestable novelty. And I would say that did not resolve. We tried to the Society of St. Pius X tried to get some doctrinal clarity, and I don't know that the response to the dubia did that. I don't know, Father, if you have anything to add there. That's a little bit ancient history,
not
I suppose,
at
this point.
I would say no, it didn't. Well, it didn't clarify things.
Well, this is a good point for us to take a quick break then, because I want to ask you about Society of St. Peter, the relationship there, about whether or not you accept canon law, the new promulgation of canon law, and what your relationship is with Sede Vacantis.
Sure.
But also then talk about possible ways forward.
Great.
All right. Thank you for listening and joining us this week on Catholic Answers Focus. Part 2, of course, will be next week on Catholic Answers Focus. And if you like what we do here, would you please share it? Let people know that they can go over to CatholicAnswersLive.com and become members of Radio Club. And if you're a member of Radio Club, we send Catholic Answers Focus right into your email account each week.